Okay, so it is my great pleasure to introduce, or actually welcome back, Anurag Anshu. Anurag did his PhD in National University of Singapore, where he did a wonderful work on convex splitting technique. And then he moved to, after his PhD, he moved to Perimeter Institute and IQC as a joint postdoc. And then several months ago, he left Waterloo to start another postdoc position at Berkeley. So during his time in Waterloo, he has published a number of very interesting papers, which are at the intersection between quantum computer science and quantum many-body physics. And I believe he will tell us a bit more about it. And Anurag welcomes, I think, questions during the talk. So you can feel free to ask questions and unmute yourself when you have questions. So, okay.
Thank you so much, Benny. As you said, I'll be talking quite a bit about this intersection between many-body physics and computer science. And yes, I really welcome any question at any time, just to keep it as interactive as it can. So quantum many-body systems are central to a variety of phenomena, such as magnetism, semiconductors, superfluids, superconductivity, and so on. Now, it turns out that in many of these phenomena, there's an important underlying notion, and that's entanglement. So what happens is that in several questions about many-body systems, in several fascinating questions, entanglement tends to play a very important role. So in my research, I look at the nature of entanglement in several many-body contexts. And one example of this would be the area laws, which I will discuss quite a bit in this talk. And as we'll see, there is another important role of ideas from computer science in my work, in particular from complexity theory, which again, I'll go into very deep details, which from my point of view, provide some definitive tools to study entanglement in the context that I mentioned. All right, so here is the outline of what you would expect from this talk. So I will start with some very important questions, and I'll describe progress in these questions. So here are they. One will be the area law problem in two-dimensional or higher dimension, two-dimensional ground states. This happens to be one of the most important and long-standing questions in the field. I will also talk about, I'll also briefly discuss a near linear time algorithm for one-dimensional Gibbs states, which was only known as in a heuristic context before our work. And now we provide rigorous justification for that. Finally, inspired by a flurry of interest in machine learning, and also given a lot of background in how physics is done in the context of condensed matter physics, I will talk about learnability of Gibbs states, which we'll see that follows from the tools that we developed in the previous two problems. Now, as you might have expected from the title, a central theme in all of this will be methods derived from computer science. In particular, you would want to look out for polynomial approximations and strong convexity. We'll see how they reveal some surprising properties of these many-body systems, which were not captured by prior methods. And as application, we'll see how these things tell us something new about quantum computing and simulation of many-body physics, and also about verification of quantum devices. All right, so without much further ado, let's dive into the details of many-body systems. So many-body systems consist of two entities. One would be particles that you see here in blue. Depending on whether you're a physicist or a quantum computer scientist, you could think of them as qubits or spins. The second element is interactions. So these particles don't really sit alone there. They talk to each other. And the laws of nature dictate that these interactions are local. So for example, I hope that you can see my cursor. So for example, the interaction between these two particles, number eight and number nine, is something that happens here, and it's described by an operator H, which does not do anything to any other particle. So notice how I'm assuming that this interaction only acts in the neighborhood. This is just a simplifying assumption, and you can think of many body systems in a much wider context. You can think of interactions that scale away and decay with scale and so on. There are several ways you can describe many body systems, but for simplicity, I'm going to assume that each interaction only acts on two particles. Now, when you combine all the interactions together, we arrive at what is known as the Hamiltonian of the system. And mathematically, it looks like this. It's a sum over all the interactions from left to right. And as I mentioned, each of the local interaction H does not do anything to particles except on which it's defined. That's why these systems are sometimes also called local Hamiltonian systems. All right. Now, specifying the Hamiltonian and describing the particles finishes the mathematical description of these systems. But it turns out that it's still far away from what happens in physics. So physics requires some more ingredients. And they come from two very important class of quantum states that live on these particles. The first quantum state is the ground state, which is the lowest energy state of the Hamiltonian. For those who know more about it, it also happens to be the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And the second one is the Gibbs state, which describes the system when it is in contact with the heat bath. Now, at very low temperature, ground states play an important role. They tend to describe what happens in physics. And at our day-to-day temperature, Gibbs states are what are more prevalent. Now, these two are very important states. And it would be really unfortunate if they could not be studied within our current computational power, for example, within using our laptops or using all the supercomputing power that is there in the world. So here's a very important question about these states. Can these be simulated efficiently on our day-to-day classical computer? And it turns out that the answer to this question is not easy. In fact, it's far from obvious. And in the past few decades, researchers in condensed matter and quantum information community have discovered is that entanglement plays a very important role in answers to this question, or at least in progress towards answers to this question. So that gives us all the reason to talk more about entanglement. So here it is. We all know entanglement as a non-classical correlation that's shared between particles, in this case, between two qubits. And it so happens that we often think of, intuitively, absence of entanglement as something classical. If two quantum states are unentangled, then we would often very quickly say, oh, these are classical. And this is a pretty nice and pretty decent intuition. And it turns out that if I make a scale of entanglement, starting from the lowest unentangled states, declaring them to be classical, and going all the way up to most entangled state, this picture helps a lot. So for example, in the context of many body systems, lack of entanglement corresponds to the system being classical. And often it's been found that those systems are easy to study on our classical computers. So it's often customary in the community of both quantum information and condensed matter physics to think of entanglement as a measure of complexity. More entangled something is, more complex is it from the point of view of studying it. And that's a point of view that that's a thread of thought that we'll take, which it will be recurrent in this talk. But we'll also pick up another thread. And this will be a different notion of complexity. And that is something not as obvious as entanglement. So let me talk more about it. Now, I will say this more in the coming slides, but ground states and Gibbs states are functions of the Hamiltonian that I described earlier. Let's just take a look as an example. So Gibbs state, I did not exactly define what Gibbs state looks like, but Gibbs state essentially is this particular function of the Hamiltonian, normalized because it has to be a quantum state. But effectively, it's this function. Now, what we can do is that we can think of approximations to a function, for example, this one, using polynomials. So for example, you could take the Gibbs state, you could take this operator, Taylor expand it, and stop this expansion at a certain degree, and you get something like this. So this is a polynomial of the Hamiltonian. But you can go more generally. You can think of more complicated polynomials. So for example, one kind of polynomial that will feature briefly in a future slide is a multivariate polynomial that looks something like this. It's more complicated, but let's see. Some coefficient times the product of local interactions plus some more coefficients and so on, and it goes in this form. Now, it has been found in some of the recent works that the smallest degree that you can achieve for such polynomial approximations is a new notion of complexity. That means you try to approximate these ground state or Gibbs state as in terms of polynomials, whether of this form or this form, and try to minimize the degree. And that happens to be a notion of complexity. It's more common for people who come from quantum information or computer science background, but it might seem something new for people from physics community, but so I'll describe this in more details in the future slides. So before we move ahead, I'll quickly summarize what we have seen so far. So we saw that entanglement is viewed as a measure of complexity in the study of many-body systems. And as I mentioned, less entanglement intuitively suggests efficient classical algorithms for the corresponding state because it makes things more classical. We also discussed that in some recent works, polynomial degree has been seen as a new notion of complexity, more from the side of quantum information. And now I will try to convince you that polynomial degree is indeed a very important notion of complexity. And in the coming slides, we'll discuss probably the best place where this features, where this expresses itself, and this will be area laws, and we'll see the power of these low degree approximations. All right, so let's start by some warm up. Let's talk about 1D area laws. So recall this collection of particles that I showed you earlier. Let's take these particles and divide this into two parts, a left and a right. Here's a little partition, if you can see it. Now, an area law behavior in one dimension is measured by entropy or the entanglement entropy between the two halves. And area law says that this entropy scales as the size of the partition, which in case is just a one simple cut. So now if you think about it, there are lots and lots of particles here and entropy tends to be extensive usually. But what area law is saying is that entropy in some systems, it depends on context, of course, but in some systems, the entropy is really low and it's a constant because it's just a small cut. So it turns out that area law is satisfied in many cases of physical interest. And in a very famous work, Hastings proved that this holds for all one-dimensional gapped ground states. Gap is a technical concept here. I will touch upon it in a coming slide. And Hastings did this via some information theoretic tools. Now, in a follow-up work, Arath Ketayev, Landau, and Vazirani, they managed to obtain the best known expression for 1D area law introducing these polynomial approximation tools that I was describing to you earlier. And they introduced the notion of Chebyshev-based polynomial approximation, and they also established connection between polynomial degree and entanglement. In fact, this goes much further, and in a follow-up work, Landau, Vidik, and Vajirani, they obtained the first provable and efficient algorithm for 1D ground states. It turns out before this work, DMRG was very, very popular and still is one of the highlight methods for studying one-dimensional ground states. But it was not known to be rigorous. There was no proof that it actually works, and these authors managed to show that was, all using the notion of polynomials. All right. So now we have been talking a lot about polynomials, so, and especially about Chebyshev-based polynomials, so I'll tell you more about it. So let's recall what we discussed in one of the earlier slides, that a ground state can be viewed as a function of the Hamiltonian. How so? Well, here's a function which takes all its value at certain number, let's say zero. Let's say zero is the ground energy, and it's zero everywhere else. Now, if the Hamiltonian has this property known as spectral gap, which means that as far as Hamiltonian is concerned, I forgot to mention that the horizontal axis labels the energy of the Hamiltonian, and vertical axis is just a real number. So as far as Hamiltonian is concerned, there are no energies in the range from zero to this number called gap. So what one can think of is that one can try to approximate this function without any concern about this particular region. And that is what Chebyshev polynomials do. These are the polynomials that they're shown here in the green line. These are the polynomials that take a very high value at zero, almost one. They do whatever they want in the gap, in the region where we don't, where the Hamiltonian doesn't care about, and then they stay small till the total energy. And it was shown by these authors that this notion of approximation to the ground state as a function has very powerful consequences. So now we are equipped with some background on the 1D area law and whatever happens there. So let's now jump right into two-dimensional systems. In two dimension, which might look something like this, it's a collection of particles which is arranged on a nice lattice. The two-dimensional area law roughly states the following. Take any region that you want. Let's say there's one over here. Let's call it A. And look at its boundary. Usually, boundary is much smaller than the region. It's not very clear from this picture because the scale is chosen somewhat incorrectly, but you could imagine that for very, very large systems, boundary is very small compared to the region inside. So if you look at our entanglement scale, here is the classical value, that's zero. Here is what entanglement would be if it's scaled as the area of the region. And if the entanglement is scaled as the volume of the region, then its value would be up here. Now it turns out that most quantum states, they happen to have a lot of entanglement because, you know, entanglement is extensive usually. But in some rare cases, entanglement can go as low as here, which sort of gets that state very close to the classical world. So this is just the area law conjecture that all the ground states, gap ground states on a two-dimensional local Hamiltonian system have entanglement right below here, not up here. So area law conjecture is not known to be true in two-dimensional lattice. There is no rigorous proof, but it has been verified in many, many cases. And it turns out that the Chebyshev polynomial approximation that was introduced by the authors that I mentioned earlier, it does not suffice to capture the area law property in two dimensions. And I will get into the details. I'll tell you briefly why this happens, not in very deep details, but let me tell you about one of our works. So in a recent work with Itai Arora and David Gossett, we showed that a class of ground states known as frustration-free ground states under local gap assumption, they satisfy a subvolume law of this form, which means that the desired point is over here, which is the area law. And we showed that these ground states are not up here, but they're somewhere in between. And in a current work in progress, we are considering the possibility of proving the area law for this class of states with some very small term. This goes to zero as the region increases. So this work and the follow-up progress that we are thinking about, they introduce a set of new tools. And I will briefly mention these tools, but I will quickly go back to our line of discussion, that is polynomials. So these tools kind of are new to this field, and they go beyond what Chebyshev polynomials can do. So for example, one of the important tools is a RGflow type of argument, which starts with polynomial approximations at smaller scales and build up a polynomial approximation for the full region. And this mapping is achieved by what is known as a robust polynomial method that we introduced in the previous work. Furthermore, we also have new notions of locality at the boundary, which crucially uses the structure of Hamiltonian near the boundary of the region. Anyway, so since our focus was all about polynomials, and in fact, all these concepts build upon polynomials, I will go back to our thread and I will talk about the polynomial approximation picture. So as I mentioned earlier, Chebyshev polynomials, they do not suffice for proving area law in two-dimensional systems. Now, it turns out that Chebyshev polynomials are optimal approximations to the ground states if your approximation choice is a constant. It's a constant error. But when error is very, very small, for example, if the error is as small as the exponential in the total energy, in this case, Chebyshev polynomials are not the optimal ones. And here, what we need is a different family of construction. So for example, in the classical case, in the classical analogs of these problems, for tiny errors, there is a theory of best polynomial approximations, which in fact has a lot to do with the theory of quantum complexity. And our observation is that area law follows if the same behavior can be reproduced in the context of ground states. Now, this all might sound fairly complicated, so let me give you a one-line summary of what really is happening. So what's happening is that this new notion of complexity that I talked about, which is the polynomial degree complexity, this comes into a very powerful play here. And what it says is that as far as the polynomial complexity is concerned, the polynomial degree is complexity is concerned, reproducing these best polynomials implies that ground states are effectively the same as classical objects. So from the point of view of complexity, these two states are the same. And because complex polynomial degree complexity is related to entanglement, this gives the way to a 2D area loss. All right. So given this, I will say a few things about where would this line of research lead to. From my point of view, there are some very exciting questions to think about. So currently, the work in progress is considering these tiny error approximations in certain context, in frustration-free context. But the main question is, would they lead to the general 2D area law, which is the frustrated systems? And that's a very interesting question to think about. I mentioned somewhere for those who already know, are in the know-how, that there's a local gap assumption there, and it turns out that removing this local gap assumption would also be another way to get to these frustration-free systems. Next interesting question from the point of view of condensed matter physics would be that if the 2D area law holds, then can this be used to construct nice representations for these ground states? And finally, would these resulting tools suffice to construct new heuristics for such ground states so that one would be able to study these on a classical computer, at least better than what's known so far. All right. So now what I'm going to change the context a little bit and talk about a slightly different family of results. And these are going to be about the Gibbs states. As I mentioned earlier, Gibbs states are a very important class of states.
Anurag, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So in your sub-volume law proof, it's nice. So does it give us any insight about the actual entanglement, structure of entanglement? Like, how it would look like or scale, the length scale of the entanglement, or like, is it localized near the boundary, or like the localized correlation length and so on.
So, right. So this line of research, it does not go via the correlation length versus area law point of view. Rather, so it does say something about the structure of these ground states. So, for example, in a follow-up to our work, Nilin Abrahamson, he showed that these states, these results lead to a PEPS representation for these ground states using with a pretty large bound dimension, but much smaller than what would happen for random quantum states. In this line of work, we are also hoping that these tools will lead to polynomial bound dimension. So this line of work might imply that these ground states can be represented by PEPs of small bound dimension.
I was about to ask, so you is it a conjecture, or you have already a proof?
It's a work in progress. So and regarding the structure, the way this line of research is going is that it's exhibiting some kind of length scale, some kind of length scale invariance. It's like it's kind of building up more complicated structure from simpler structure. So there may be also a RG flow type of properties there. So this might tell a lot about the structure in 2D, but then that would require further investigation.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry, quick question. Can you explain what you mean exactly by frustration-free?
Right. So frustration-free assumption simply means that the ground state, so if you think of each Hamiltonian as a penalty for the state, that means that each interaction, if it's non-zero, then if it's violated, then it's like giving a penalty. Frustration-free simply means that that the ground state, it satisfies all the Hamiltonian terms. Or in other terms, that if the Hamiltonian is a positive, if you scale the energy in a manner that it's non-zero, then the ground energy is zero. That would be the positive. That would be the meaning of frustration-free. Does that answer the question?
Just make sure I understand. It doesn't mean that all the terms commute, right?
No. It isn't. So just let me go back to this, where did I describe the... Right. So imagine that each of the H is a positive operator, each of the local terms. Then frustration-free says that the ground energy is zero. That means there is a state that satisfies all the things. But it doesn't mean commuting. For commuting case, area law is very easy to prove.
Is there any Hamiltonian that doesn't satisfy this rule? I mean, as long as it's bounded from below?
There are Hamiltonians that don't. So for example, if you take antiferromagnet, for example, then for example, if you ask each of these qubits to be in a EPR state, which will not really happen because of monogamy of entanglement, then there is no quantum state which can, which is going to be an EPR state. So that's like a violation. And so each term gets violated. So all the parent Hamiltonians of PEPs, they are all frustration free, but you can have frustrated Hamiltonians, which
I see what you mean.
Yeah.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. So again, going back to this this second line of research, which has a lot to do with polynomial approximations, let's talk about Gibbs states. So Gibbs states in one dimension are again very important class of systems, and there's a lot of effort in trying to simulate them using classical computers. And there are several heuristics. It turns out that these heuristics work very well in practice. They in fact achieve near linear time. But there is no rigorous proof of why these things achieve near linear time. there are proofs that these things will work in polynomial time, but not as close as linear. So in a recent work with Tomotaka Kuwahara and Alvaro Alhambra, who was at Perimeter Institute before moving to Germany, we show that in one dimension Gibbs states on, let's say, n particles, at some inverse temperature beta, there is a classical algorithm that runs in near linear time with some very small correction, and it is able to simulate these Gibbs states. So that's the technical theorem. But what does this do with the discussion that we're having right now? So it turns out that the key tool again is polynomial approximations to the function. And because we are thinking about Gibbs states, so it's obvious to think about the Gibbs function, the exponential function. Now, what do we really mean by polynomial approximation? Because since 1715, people have been thinking about Taylor series and what's new here. So whatever we proved in this theorem, why couldn't this be done like long back? So it turns out that what's very important here is again the notion of optimal polynomial approximations, which is the optimal complexity, which is how I defined polynomial complexity in the very beginning. And it turns out that again, looking back at work that's been done in computer science, Chebyshev-based approximations again to these functions substantially improve upon what happens in the Taylor series. And as a result, they allow us to prove the theorems that of the kind that I described earlier. In fact, if someone here is also interested in the entanglement properties of these Gibbs states, then we have another theorem which says that Gibbs states on a lattice that satisfy an area law that looks like temperature to the power 2/3 times the boundary length. And this improves upon the prior work around 12 years ago by Wolf, Rastate, Sirak, Hastings, and Sirak, which had this this beta in the front. And it suggests as well that the entanglement generated in imaginary time evolution spreads sublinear in the inverse temperature, unlike linear, which you would expect in, for example, linear time evolution. All right. So now, as I promised you,
can I ask? So the result for 1D was is the gap is assumed or no?
Once again, in which case?
Oh, this 1D result, the.
This one?
The Gibbs state, yeah. The gap is part of the assumption. No.
There's no gap here. There's no gap here.
I see.
Yeah. Gibbs
state. And for area row, well, the beta 3 over 2, it's for 2D and 3D. And
Any dimensions.
So there's no way that the dimension comes into play, or is it something you can combine with your previous result and then?
So dimension comes into this big O notation.
Oh, big O, so I see.
Yeah. There are terms related to dimension here, right?
Uh-huh. Right. So can I ask one more question? So you have this 2D subvolume law result. If you apply that technique in 3D, what would you get?
So in 3D, it would not give anything. And that's for some very subtle reasons, which unfortunately I won't be able to get into in this talk.
I see. Okay, thank you.
So, all right. So any more questions?
I have a question.
Right.
So, and you said that there's like a Chebyshev based approximation that improves the exponential minus beta hx. I'm just wondering, say, what would happen for, let's say, I don't want Gibbs state, but I want the exponential iht, the time evolution thing.
So for that, Chebyshev approximation does not improve upon Taylor series. So, for that reason, our proof technique would not give anything for imaginary time evolution, which is as expected in real time evolution. So in real time evolution, the entanglement spreads linear with time, and these techniques are consistent with that. They don't give anything new in the real time case.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no problem. All right, now, as I promised you in the beginning, any more questions regarding this? Okay, cool. Now, as I promised you earlier, I was going to tell some applications about quantum computing. So it turns out these results have a lot to say about quantum computing as well. So let's look back at the original motivation by Feynman on why one should have a quantum computer, which was to have something programmable, which can be used to simulate these systems, which tend to be hard. So for example, given our current techniques, we don't know how to simulate ground states on a 2D. So one thing you could think of is, well, one could program these things on a computer, especially if the interactions are too complicated to exist in nature, and then do measurements and then figure out properties. So that's a good motivation for quantum computer. But the results of the kind that I described to you earlier, including all the prior results, they challenge the need for quantum computers in this context, because they say that, look, these systems probably can be simulated using your classical computer. So they kind of push the limit on the necessity of quantum computation in these tasks. So more results of this kind, they really illuminate the interplay between classical and quantum computation. So they are very important from that point of view as well. And that's also one of the reasons why quantum information and computing communities is very involved in this area of research. All right, so here's a summary of everything we saw in the second section. So polynomial approximations to ground states are leading to powerful insights into the entanglement structure of, well, ground states, which was not accessible by the information theoretic tools, particularly the ones developed by Hastings himself. And polynomial approximations to the Gibbs state have similar consequences where things are efficient, that is polynomial time anyway, but what matters is the runtime, whether it's linear or superlinear. Now, it turns out that there's going to be more to say on this notion of complexity. And this will be switching gears quite a bit. But as you'll see that all the things we discussed in this section and the previous will have implications on what I'll be discussing next. So I can pause and take questions before moving to the last section. Okay. All right. So now we'll discuss about the last section, which will be learning interactions from the Gibbs state. So let me motivate this problem from a different direction, and then I will try to bring it back to what we discussed earlier. So here's a very formal way to see what this problem really is. So imagine you have a device, a system which prepares a Gibbs state. And the Gibbs state is based on some Hamiltonian, on some interaction, which is not known to us, which is known to the device, but not to us. And let's say we have the power to get several independent samples from this device. That means we ask device many, many times, and it can give us a new sample of this Gibbs state. And the question is, can I figure out what these interactions are originally, which only the device knows, not us, by doing quantum measurements on these systems, and preferably by doing as simple quantum measurements as possible, and with as small number of samples as possible. We don't want to bother the device too much. So where does this problem really come in? I mean, is it natural or artificial? So it turns out, if we go down a rather philosophical road, this kind of problem is inherent in the methods of physics itself. I mean, if there's a new interaction or a new Hamiltonian to be discovered in nature, then the samples that we get from the nature, which describes those interactions, is usually in the Gibbs state, because that's how physical systems are at our room temperature. So you'd imagine, for example, a very complex new material for which we know very little about, let's say some new kind of material in which the effective interactions are unknown to us, and we want to probe that. We want to figure out what those effective interactions are. Then we would expect that, well, I mean, this system is in the Gibbs state, and we would want something like the previous task to figure out what those interactions actually are. So this is also known as the inverse problem in the community of physics, or also in machine learning. Next, more recently, in the context of quantum computing, these problems are picking up speed. So for example, Gibbs states are turning out to be very, very important in recent quantum algorithms. Let's say the STP solver of Brandau and Spohr. Now, if you want to design a quantum computer that actually implements this subroutine of Gibbs sampling, then you'd also want to verify that the quantum computer is doing what it's supposed to do. So you would run the quantum computer, you'd get a Gibbs state, you would sample a Gibbs state, and then you'd try to verify that indeed the Hamiltonian in the Gibbs state is exactly what you wanted it to be. So this is where you'd use this problem as well. And just from the point of view of quantum learning theory, for example, a recent work of Amin et al, where Roger Melko was a co-author, they defined what is known as the quantum Boltzmann machine. And there it was a very natural generalization of the classical, a very popular classical Boltzmann machine. So from the point of view of quantum learning theory, this is a very important task. And in fact, there are very, very interesting and very powerful heuristic results which work extremely well in practice. So since this talk is of a more of a theoretical nature, we'll be interested in the theoretical rigorous results concerning this learning problem. So why do we expect that the Gibbs state should be learnable in the first place? Why do we expect that we should be able to access the Hamiltonian just by looking at the sample and small number of samples? And the motivation for that, in fact, this was the motivation when we first thought about this problem, was precisely what I described to you in the previous few sections, that these Gibbs states on lattices have simple entanglement structure, and also they have low degree polynomial approximation, which means that their complexity is low in both the notions that I discussed in this talk. And you'd expect on intuitive grounds that if there is a family of states that has low complexity of any intuitive nature, then you would expect that you can learn them. And in fact, there are many, many kinds of states that you can imagine in quantum or classical computing where these objects are of low complexity and learning them is important. And this is something which should make you guess that learning should be possible for these Gibbs states. On the other hand, there are some bottlenecks. So one bottleneck is that entanglement, although it's small in Gibbs states, is not too small. It's not really a classical object. So there is quite a presence of entanglement there. And what it can do is that it can completely delocalize the information about each interaction. So if you happen to recall the interaction H89 in one of the previous very early slides, it may happen that that H89, the information about that might be spread all across the system. And what does that happen? That's because of this mathematical property called the Markov condition. Classically, such a thing would never happen. Classically, the information stays where it is, or at least in the neighborhood. But quantum Gibbs states tend to violate this notion as the Markov condition very, very strongly. And as a result, the information, there's no guarantee that the information can stay where it is. So this clearly required, let me also mention that this Markov condition is very important tool in classical learning problem, in classical learning of classical Gibbs states, which are also known as Boltzmann machines. So in a recent work, we do manage to achieve a learning result for this task, and we show that the Hamiltonian can be learned with good accuracy with samples which are polynomial in the number of particles. The algorithm is time efficient at high temperatures and also for sign-free Hamiltonians, but in general it's not known to be efficient, and that's a very interesting open question. And our sample complexity that we achieve is also tight. So given all the intuition that I talked about and the bottleneck that I talked about, what really is the key tool that we use here? Turns out that the tool we use, again, comes from methods that are used in computer science, especially in optimization. And that is known as strong convexity. Unfortunately, I won't have time to get into the details of strong convexity. It tends to be of a rather complicated nature. So what I will tell you is that strong convexity lets us prove the following intuition. What happens is that the information, there's no intuition here. So strong convexity lets us prove the following result, that information about the interactions, however delocalized by the information, by the entanglement, can still be accessed via simple quantum measurements. So So there is a lot of things, a lot of research to be done in this direction of learnability, given the importance of this problem. So for example, can our result, which is time efficient in some regime, can be made fully time efficient at all possible temperatures? Given that now several industries and research labs are able to engineer interactions that are not necessarily on a lattice, they can have all-to-all connectivity, is it possible to learn Hamiltonians over arbitrary interaction graph of arbitrary geometry? Next, as I mentioned earlier, one of the intuitions for our result was that Gibbs states have low complexity. So how far does this intuition really go? For example, is it possible to learn any interesting class of state which is of low complexity? For example, ground states, or states which are PEPs or MPS. So one can ask a host of such questions which are turning out to be more and more relevant with time. So one would expect a learning theory of all such objects. So with this, I'll move on to my conclusion, but before that, I'm happy to take questions.
Yeah, I have a question. So I'm guessing you're probably intending not to mention that, but when you mentioned the Markov condition, what exactly did you mean?
Right. So, okay, so I think, let me spend a couple of minutes to explain what it is. I'll have to go back to the previous picture. One sec. Let me just take this picture, for example. This would help. So imagine you have a Gibbs state on this graphene, and Markov condition would say the following, that if you look at the state on some particles over here, this state only depends on the values in the neighborhood, in the sense that if I condition on what's happening in the neighborhood of this particle, I can completely determine the state over here. So it doesn't depend on anything outside. So mathematically, it says that.
Sorry to cut you up. More specifically, do you mean the mutual information, or something else?
So I mean condition which information is zero. That means the information that this particle has about everything else, condition on its boundary, is zero. Essentially.
Oh, why would most of the quantum Gibbs state don't satisfy this?
So Gibbs states at temperature below a threshold temperature violate this condition. So above a threshold temperature, like at high temperatures, Gibbs states approximately satisfy it. I mean, in the sense that the condition mutual information stays small but not zero. But there are examples. For example, I would expect that if you just picked up a random example of Hamiltonian and low enough temperature, it would violate the Markov condition. But to be more specific, in four dimensions, Hastings has an example of violation of topological order at high temperatures, which is in fact, that's a model where the Gibbs state condition is violated a lot. Sorry, the Markov chain condition is violated a lot. The conditional mutual information is a constant. But nevertheless, it's still open whether this conditional mutual information is really just a constant or very, very large. I'm not sure. I'm not aware of a work which says that it's really huge. So it's a possibility that it's actually small and that could be used. But those tools are not available to us yet.
Okay, I see. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no problem.
Hey, Anuru?
Yeah, hi.
So you made an assumption about high temperature and no sign problem, is that right?
Oh, so let me get to that. Sorry. So all I was saying is that, I should have stated more carefully. So in our algorithm, the sample complexity is near optimal for all Hamiltonians at all temperatures, like polynomially optimal. The algorithm is time efficient at high temperatures or when the Hamiltonian is sign free.
The sign free at all temperatures?
Sign free at any temperature. So we can fix a temperature, let's say some beta. And at that temperature, the Hamiltonian should be sign free. And then.
Okay, thanks.
Can I ask a question about the measurement, the quantum measurements? Which measurements do you mean? Is it just measurements in the computational basis, or are these information and complete measurements? Like what type?
Right. So So the simple measurements. These are measurements on a few qubits. So it would not be in a computational basis. We would have to measure all the Pauli operators, but they would be acting on constant number of particles. Like if the Hamiltonian is too local, then they were acting on two particles, like all pairs of two particles.
I see. Thank you.
Okay, so I will move on to the outlook. And so just looking back at what we discussed, there are some notions out there which are natural to both physics and computer science. So for example, time efficiency makes sense for both areas. Randomness appears in physics as global dynamics, and it's very important in computer science. And also concepts like non-locality, which actually originated in physics and then moved to computer science. But we discussed some notions that are very inherent to computer science. For example, efficiency or complexity in terms of polynomial approximations, the concept of strong convexity. These notions, they originate in computer science, but it seems that they're effective in the many-body systems in the context of describing many-body physics. So as observed by Wigner in his famous essay, it seems that we do need some further understanding of what's going on here. Or if we can't do that, then at least we need a legendary essay like the Wigner wrote. So I hope someone can write it in the future. But maybe it's also possible that these connections are not that surprising in the end. So for example, if you go back to the history of all these computer science notions, for example, if you go back to the work of Chebyshev that started the theory of polynomial approximations, it turns out that he was really thinking about physical problems. He was thinking about comparing different mechanisms of motion transfer, especially in the steam engine. So maybe what's really happening is that we are kind of going back in full circles. So here I'll end the talk with a quote by Umesh Vajrani, which I like, which is that, are we coming full circle, or are we spiraling into something deeper, into a deeper connection? So with that, thank you so much for your attention.
Okay. Thank you, Anurag. So I think we had lots of questions during the talk, but I guess we still have time for questions. So
Great. If
anyone has questions.
Oh, I can also go back to screen sharing.
I have a question about the area law.
I should share the screen as well. Sorry, I missed that. Yeah, please.
Yeah. So once you prove the area law for 2D, let's say, will higher D be quickly doable, or it's going to be an entirely different game for each dimension?
So the higher D would require some new concepts, actually. Given our current line of thought, this would not easily generalize to higher dimensions. And luckily, we understand what are the reasons for that, what are the bottlenecks. So it would require some concepts which unfortunately I could not get into, but that's actually another talk itself to talk about.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Tim raised hand. Hi, Tim.
Do you think there's like a phase transition in the learning complexity for sine problem Hamiltonian in temperature?
That's a great question. I mean, is it, right. So in the sense of time efficiency, right? Is it possible that at low temperatures, if we don't have sine free, then is it not possible to learn it? We don't know. But let me remark one thing. Phase transition also happens classically, that we know. But classically, we have learning algorithms at all temperatures. So if there was a phase transition of this kind which happened in the quantum learning problem, that would be something really uniquely quantum reasons and not classical reasons. So that would be something very interesting to answer in its own.
I see. Thanks.
So I have a naive question. So why is ChefChef polynomial so special?
That's a question which I hope someone can answer. I guess, no, honestly, I don't know. I'm really not sure why is that the case. And that is quite unreasonable, as the title suggests. And it somehow shows up at several places. So for example, Chebyshev polynomials show up also in quantum algorithms like Grover speedup and so on. But I don't feel we really understand why it is useful at all. And that's a great question, I think.
So do you expect there might be better bases that give you a tighter bound, or?
So for some problems, Chebyshev polynomials are actually optimal, and one does not expect, or more precisely, Chebyshev type polynomials are optimal and one does not expect better things. But in many cases, particularly for 2D or 3D area laws, proving those results, one would go beyond Chebyshev polynomials, and they tend to be, you know, they're all derived from Chebyshev polynomials, but they are of more complicated nature. So depending on the context, so the answer to your questions would be depends on the context. In some contexts, there would be better polynomials than Chebyshev polynomials.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
No problem.
Do you worry about this topological, this spurious topological entanglement entropy? There's these counterexamples that show up, but not exact. Well, it would be maybe in the case where you would expect that there is no topological entanglement entropy, where there winds up looking like there is some.
So sorry, John, I couldn't follow the question entirely. Could you please?
Are you worried about these counterexamples that have the spurious topological entanglement entropy? Does that show up at all in your picture?
Oh, you mean in this learning picture?
Even in terms of trying to prove an area law.
So it depends on what method we are using. So if you're using information theoretic methods for proving area law, there we would expect that those bottlenecks might be there. Mm-hmm. But if you're using the polynomial based approach, sorry, that I was describing here, I have not yet seen the limitations or features of topological entanglement entropy. But in the context of Gibbs states, learning Gibbs states, as someone asked earlier, why is the Markov condition violated? That's where that becomes important. And in fact, even at high temperatures, one can see why that coming in.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no problem.
Any other question? If not, yeah, let's thank Anurag again.
Thank you. It was very nice to meet all of you again.